Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Carol Harnett, and I am the president from the Council for Disability Awareness, and I am so happy to welcome you to our podcast that is called the Financial Health and Income Network. I am so pleased to be joined by my colleague, Fred Schott, who runs the research initiatives of the Council for Disability Awareness. And we wanted to have a conversation with you today that will also be transcribed into a blog post that will appear on the Council for Disability Awareness blog site, which is blog.disabilitycanhappen.org, on Tuesday, April 5th. And as we kick off in this time of year, starting for the Council for Disability Awareness on April 4th, the season of talking about income protection, which includes products primarily like disability insurance, whether it's individual or group, short and long-term disability, which is given to employees via the work site, either where the employer pays all or part of the premium, or the employee can access it through the work site or through associations, and we'll talk about this more later. But this is the season we talk about this a lot with consumers, in the aspect, at least from the Council for Disability Awareness approach, for how you look at all of your financial wellness and your financial planning and your selection of employee benefits. And one of the things that we have been thinking about for the past couple of years, starting almost immediately pre-pandemic, is whether disability insurance is actually a luxury good here in the United States. And so that's what Fred and I are going to be talking to you about today for, you know, up to about the next 30 minutes. So Fred, first of all, welcome. Thank you so much for being willing to have this conversation live with me.
Oh, great. I'm glad to be able to do it. We know that lots of good stuff comes out of our informal conversation. So hopefully we can reproduce that magic in this podcast.
Absolutely. That's what we hope. And I will warn the listening audience that both Fred and I work virtually, and I do have a puppy. So I apologize if my puppy decides to bark at all and you can hear him in the background. So, Fred, I think to just level set this for everybody, even people who've been in the field for a long time, let's just talk about, if you don't mind first, you know, how many people in the United States who work do or don't have some form of disability insurance or disability coverage?
So do you want me to start by cutting to the chase and giving the answer and then talking about how we got there? Or do you want me to build up the story before getting to the punchline? I didn't go either way.
you can answer whatever way you'd like. So how about that?
So, at any rate, the bottom line, and this is based on an exercise that I did like 4 years ago, 2018. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds about right. 4 years ago, I went through an exercise. The long and the short of it is, at that time, estimated about 51 million working Americans were without any kind of disability coverage, be it short or long-term disability. Interestingly enough, that number was validated by the chief economist at the American Council for Life Insurance. I have, you know, I can make available the links to both my article where I talked about my methodology and also to the chief economist's methodology as well, his article at that time. And I think we can put that into the show notes. But so that was basically the bottom line. But it was interesting to get there. My methodology, I kind of laid out a number of assumptions, and that was starting with what do the numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics say about the percentage of workers that have short and or long-term disability coverage through their employers. BLS tracks that kind of information through their annual employee benefits survey. But they do that for basically the civilian labor force net of federal government employees and some other employment situations. And they do that, they track benefits, only those benefits where the employer pays all or part of the cost of the benefit coverage. So that's an important concept to keep in mind. So, you know, taking a look at that, and then taking a look at some other sources that individuals can receive a disability coverage independently of through their employers as an employee benefit. And that would include voluntary workplace coverage. That would include coverage through what in the industry we call association affinity groups. That's basically if you're like in a professional association that can offer coverage if you're a member of that professional association, or affinity groups, college alumni association, that's another big one, affinity groups like the AAA or whatever. So that's another source of coverage. And then finally, individual coverage. You go to see your financial advisor, and your financial advisor can place you for individual disability coverage with a carrier that offers that. And now, of course, that's somewhat of a different market than the first one. So anyway, so there were a number of assumptions made using all of those elements in there. And again, if you have a link to the piece that I wrote, you can see. And this was, again, 4 years ago. At the end, I put in a little call to action saying, like, hey, I welcome any sanity checks on this. And I'm not aware, aside from the ACLI chief economist, anybody else that has sought to challenge or replicate those numbers. So for what it's worth, that was where it came from. So what's interesting is looking at those numbers there. Sure.
Fred, if you don't mind me interrupting just for a second, I just want to say you did, though, reach out to people who are experts in individual and in group and in association affinity and voluntary, and they all felt comfortable with the numbers you had chosen for their subspecialties. So that's important for the audience to know. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's true. So you know, looking at that, you know, for the people who do have the coverage, you know, the 50,000-foot view is like really the biggest way, the biggest route for people to get the disability insurance coverage. You know, let's say about 85% through the employer, and then the remaining 15% is either the individual or the association affinity route, with slightly more of that 15% being the individual route than the association affinity route. And within the employer group, people who get it through the employer, it's like a 90-10 split there. 90% of people where the employer pays all or part of the cost of the coverage, and then the remaining 10% is voluntary worksite, where basically you can enroll in the plan at the worksite, but you yourself pay with your own money. You pay for the coverage. And, of course, that has some advantages to it, because if you pay the premium on your disability coverage, then the benefits coming as a result of that flow to you on a tax-free basis. But to the extent that your employer subsidizes the cost, then to that same extent, your benefits, when you do get to the point of having to collect them, are taxable. So anyway, so it was the $51 million, and then.
Yeah. Go ahead, Fred.
Okay, yeah. I was going to say that the $51 million, again, the numerator and the denominator, there were a variety of estimates of the overall, you know, civilian labor force, net of federal employees and the like. But based on that, that equates to over a third. So the Council for Disability Awareness is part of their, ongoing awareness campaigns. One of the graphics is that, you know, one in three is without adequate disability coverage.
Mm-hmm. And that's really important
that
because, you know, and there's a lot of debate. You know, you could argue that Fred and I have a prejudice toward this product, and we absolutely do, but we also, frankly, you know, consulting for and working for a nonprofit organization, we think broadly, and we think broadly about benefits. And as people who've been around benefits a long time, both as people who receive them and people who've been working in and around the space a long time, you know, when I think about benefits, and I was one time asked when I wrote the benefits column for Human Resource Executive by HR executives to write a column on how I would advise employees to think about benefits personally, and this is my personal opinion. I think your health insurance is the most important, you know, benefit you select, and it's we could do a whole separate show on how you think about your health insurance, but your health insurance is incredibly important. And then, frankly, your income insurance, which is disability insurance, is a big player underneath that umbrella, probably the biggest player, is really incredibly important. And then, of course, your retirement planning, which is an important part of financial planning, is critically important. And it's just in many ways another form of income insurance, is this income, you know, insurance that pays out once you are no longer working. So that's my hierarchy for how I think about benefits. And interestingly enough, I saw, and I'll put a link to it. There was a post on LinkedIn by a consultant, and their consulting house had done the quote unquote final four, or actually I think they did this week 16 of benefits, and kind of had their internal battle of which product they thought was most important. And the winner of their final four championship was long-term disability insurance. They rated as the single most important benefit, both whether an employer provided that through paying the premium or whether you chose to do it through a voluntary offering, meaning that you're paying the premium. So, Fred, with that in mind, I think what people often don't know about, and I'm going to include not just consumers, but I'm going to include employers here because they play such an incredibly large role in the United States, on how people receive disability coverage. Can you help walk the audience through the difference between high wage earners, the people who are the top 10 and 25% of wage earners in the United States, and lower wage earners, the lowest 25% and 10%, their access to insurance, these kinds of insurance products, primarily through the workplace?
Sure, sure. And that is where the most robust set of figures is available, is through the workplace and in particular through employer-sponsored benefits options, the kind of stuff that the Bureau of Labor Statistics includes in its regular ongoing employee benefits survey, which is part of a larger survey that they do on the employer cost of employee compensation. So these numbers, I know we were talking earlier, there may be some slight differences here, but the numbers that I'm looking at, and I'm looking at some handwritten notes that I made, so I'm not going to the actual, page itself in the latest BLS release, but looking at their most recent 2021 survey, participation and for the entire civilian labor force, where they do categorize people in accordance with their where they fall in the wage percentile. For the people who are in the lowest 25%, the lowest quartile in terms of how much they get paid, and I'm looking, the numbers I'm looking at are for actual participation, and there's some overlap. I mean, access to and participation in for these particular benefits are pretty much within 2 or 3 percentage points the same. So anyway, actual participation, the lowest for short-term disability, people in the lowest income quartile, only 19% have coverage. But in the highest quartile, the highest 25th percentile, earnings-wise, 63%. So that's for short-term disability. Now, for long-term disability, 10% of the people in the lowest income quartile participate in that coverage, and in the highest quartile, 58% participate in the coverage. So, you know, there's a big disconnect. And I know if you and I do not have the numbers. Yes, I do. I have them ready to hand here for the top and bottom 10%. The numbers go even, you know, are even more skewed. So, for example, the lowest 10% short-term disability, only 9% have it. The highest 10% short-term disability, 71% have it. And then for long-term disability, it's 4% and 70%. So definitely there's the whole equation is skewed. And my guess is that for the other sectors, the other sources, probably reflects a similar disparity. I mean, let's face it, on the individual end, I mean, we subscribe to the same industry journals and the like, and when we, you know, trade association magazines and the like, and you open it up and you see talk in their coverage, especially on the individual level, talk about disability insurance. You know, who seems to be the target market there? It's, you know, your doctors, your lawyers, your high-paid professionals. My guess is, you know, if we were to run a study to show similar income distributions for that individual market, we'd find something very similar to what we see, if not more so than what BLS is showing. So, yeah, it does show that the better you're paid, the more likely you are to have disability insurance. And, you know, the same kind of thing came out in consumer survey that the CDA did, that it had commissioned back in 2019, right? That was, about 2 years ago at this time, I had put out a piece for the CDA that picked up on some of the findings there. And that showed also that as income levels went down, so did the likelihood to have disability coverage. So, yeah.
Yes, and that lowest group in that survey, Fred, of 40%, almost 40% of consumers said that their savings, if they had any, would last less than 1 month if they couldn't work due to an injury, illness, or pregnancy. So it's interesting that the people who need this kind of coverage the most have the least access to it, both in the workplace and individually, and also are less likely to be a member of an association. So their only other way to get it potentially is through a voluntary, an employee pay all benefit is the only way they can get to it. And they're the ones who need it more than anybody, which we saw some of in the early stages of the pandemic when people needed to leave the workplace. We saw that kind of disparity, which was resolved through what Congress passed to help people as a stopgap get through some of their financial losses that were associated with the pandemic. So it was a good example. Yeah. Now, you know, I'm thinking, Fred, as we're talking about this, for if we have consumers listening or even financial professionals who just really are less familiar with income replacement or income protection products like disability insurance, you know, we should probably talk a little bit about, like, what causes people, what kind of conditions or situations cause people to leave the workplace. And, you know, what you and I know, and certainly people who've worked in the space for even a short time know, is when you say the word disability to someone, even someone who works in the health professions, the first image that comes to their mind are the least likely but most catastrophic, which is people who wind up in situations like spinal cord injuries where they use a wheelchair, or someone who loses all or some of the visual capabilities, or people who are deaf. They think of, you know, I hate using this term, but like classic disabilities. And that's really not the main reason why people go out of work. Would you mind just reviewing for people what are the primary reasons why people go out of work not related to occupational injuries that would be covered by something like workers' compensation.
Yeah, workers' comp. And just as a little sidebar, and first of all, let me caveat everything I'm saying here with the fact that, of course, 2 years ago, the landscape changed dramatically as
right.
a result of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously changed the whole picture of, you know, what kind of conditions are keeping people out of work and the like. And truth be told, the industry is kind of sorting through that now and trying to apportion everything into appropriate buckets. So the numbers that I'm going to cite to you are, again, pre-pandemic numbers. My sense is from what I've seen that, a lot of the, underlying patterns will, once you factor out COVID and everything, remain pretty much the same. But the fact is these numbers, the context is pre-pandemic. So as a general rule of thumb, in the pre-pandemic time, you mentioned occupational. So, more or less around 1% of all employees had some kind of on-the-job occupational injury or illness that caused them to lose time from work. But then flip it around. If you take a look at non-occupational reasons, specifically short-term disability statistics, it's about 5%. So much more likely, you are much more likely to not be able to work for, at least a short period of time, short-term disability being like three to 6 months or less, as a result of a non-occupational factor. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. Now, for these non-occupational factors, interestingly enough, over the years, the number one reason for disability or not being able to work on a short-term basis would be pregnancy. But that number or that percentage, has been drifting downwards over the last 10 years, reflecting the fact that, the birth rate has been going down as well. It's been drifting down to like less than one out of four. But still, that was the major reason. But then next most common, we're talking about things like musculoskeletal disorders, so problems of the back, spine, knees, hips, shoulders, other parts of the body. And about one in five short-term disabilities are a result of that. And in most cases, that's usually the result of some kind of surgery or other medical procedure to treat the underlying musculoskeletal condition. So, classic example, somebody's got hip arthritis. They need a hip replacement. You're out of work for several weeks. And that's also an important thing to note, that the nature of work you do and the kind of work you do will have an influence on how long you might not be able to work if you have a particular condition. So, for example, like a hip replacement surgery, I had one last year. I was able to get back to work, at least on a part-time basis, fairly quickly within 2 weeks. Help that I had a kind of work that could be done remotely, did not require a lot of physical exertion and the like. But let's say if I had been a warehouse worker or a factory worker or whatever, I would have been out minimum 6 to 8 weeks. So anyway. Again, as a result of surgery to treat a condition. The other thing is, classic injuries, fractures, sprains, strains, and the like, just a little bit more than 10% of short-term disability. So it is a leading category, but it's not a particularly, overwhelmingly large one. So there's that. And then another category that over the years is growing, not just because this is becoming more of an issue, mental health is becoming more of an issue societally, but also if there's work that requires a lot of cognitive and mental focus, then it is a more prominent disabling condition. So these are, also, but less than 10%, where that is the primary reason for disability. Now, once you go into the long term, the picture changes a little bit more. Long term disabilities, 3 to 6 months, more than that. far and away, you know, approaching one out of every three are, again, these musculoskeletal disorders. But then the next one, about 15% or so, cancer. And then people recovering from heart attack, stroke, neurological disorders and the like, they come in behind those two particular categories. So, disability is not necessarily what you may think. These are, you know, health conditions that can affect all of us at some point or another in our life. A little sidebar there, the statistic that's thrown out quite frequently is Social Security data. Their actuarial analysis show that if you're starting out in the workforce, you have a 1 in 4 chance of being disabled before you reach your normal retirement age. But what's interesting and what most people don't really pay attention to in those Social Security studies is that less than 10% of people starting out to work can expect to die before they reach their normal retirement age and not be disabled in the process. So, mm-hmm. You know, everybody buys life insurance, right? I mean, not everybody, but, you know, people buy a whole lot more life insurance than they buy disability insurance. Yet the kind of scenario that people follow when they do that, you know, they assume like, oh, well, what if I die before I reach age 65? And they assume that they won't get disabled in the process. The odds of that happening are a whole lot less. They're less than 10%.
So, people need to take that into account.
Yeah,
so we've got about 3 minutes left, and I know that we could talk about this. Unfortunately for listeners, you can probably tell we could talk about this all day. But, you know, kind of to bring our conversation full circle, one of the things we hope you've taken away from this is, one is disability insurance is really important, and two is a lot of people who work don't have it. And you can get it on your own. You can get it through associations. You can get it through through the workplace where you pay for it yourself if your employer is not paying for it. But I would encourage, particularly employers who are listening, to really look at providing some form of, even if it's a partial payment of the insurance premiums for disability coverage, for particularly your lowest wage workers, that bottom 10 and 25% of your workforce, because they're the ones who actually need it the most. And until we do something like that, until we really encourage access, disability insurance really almost is seen as one of the luxury benefits, something people really need but don't tend to spend their own money in procuring it. And we know from firsthand experience that the far majority of us will at least temporarily be out of the workplace for a period of time and then return. So this is not about catastrophic disability in many cases. It's about temporary disability in probably the majority of cases. And Fred, I just want to say thank you for having this conversation with me. Is there any final closing remark that you would like to leave the audience with?
Well, again, it's not a luxury good, and also that Social Security table, okay, the disconnect between the 25% for disability and the 8% for death without disability. If you just bought life insurance and didn't make arrangements for disability insurance, you were probably misreading the odds. So that would be the final
what a great point.
Final thought that I would offer. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, first of all, to our listening audience. So, Fred, I should thank you first, but I'm going to thank you last. To our listening audience, thank you for listening to this and considering what we have to say and knowing that we talk about this all the time. Feel free to reach out to us to follow the blog at blog.disabilitycanhappen.org, which is the Council for Disabilities blog page. And then, of course, thank you so much to my friend and my colleague, Fred, who was shared such great information for you. As I said, you can look for an annotated transcript of this on our April 5th blog post at blog.disabilitycanhappen.org. And so thank you, Fred, and thank you to the audience.
Okay. Bye-bye.